Well, good morning, everyone. Want to talk a little bit about the memoir, and one of the things that I this is something that I wrote in my own memoir. It was a long time, and you know, so I'm stealing from myself a little bit here, and thinking about how I was trying to integrate history with memory. I wrote, memory must be informed by history, lest history becomes distorted when viewed only through the lens of memory. So, and I think that's a lot of what we're doing here is trying to blend those, you know, history and memory in some ways. And when I wrote those words, I had no idea of how history was actually informing memory, as well as memory informing history, would become a part of my work as a writer. I like to think of myself really as an accidental memoirist, because when I went to Mississippi in 1999 to do research in the Sovereignty Commission files, I went there with the idea of writing a narrative history about the commission where all of the various people who were part of that power structure in the state would be characters. But it was when I got into the research I realized how much I was attached to that story and my family was part of that story. So there are times when the subject you write about is so intertwined with your own personal history that separating memory and history can be difficult. Now, thinking about what the readings that we were doing here, the three memoirs that we read, what I see that they have in common is that they're intensely personal pieces that reveal a unique window into the cultural history of this country. Frederick Buchner's The Sacred Journey provides a window in this upper crust WASP culture and how his grandmothers passed along certain perspectives from that culture. Maxine Hong Kingston takes you inside the struggles of women who immigrated from China and through a humorous and sometimes painful story. And Richard Wright's personal experience of trying to educate himself in the American South says a great deal about the era that shaped him, but it also, you know, someone who spent 6 months in Mississippi, it rings very true in the present. And these aren't just good stories. They're stories that make you think. And they start to make me think a little bit about how to approach my topic. Now, one of the things that as I was reading these, I have this book called, In Fact, The Best of Creative Nonfiction. And when I, last fall, for the Wall Street Journal, I reviewed a new book on the Emmett Till murder. And I think that it's probably my point of view from that has gotten me banned from writing for the Wall Street Journal. It's another story.
Really?
But anyway. But John Edgar Wideman wrote an essay about the famous photo of Emmett Till that appeared in Jet magazine. And it's a really, you know, it's an image that's very charged and has a lot of storytelling potential. And also, you know, all photographs are memento mori. They do make us think about our own mortality. And that photo does that very profoundly. And here's something that he wrote about this, and this is something, he said, Curtis Jones, a cousin who accompanied Emmett Till on the trip from Chicago, Illinois to Money, Mississippi in August 1955, relates how close Emmett Till came to missing their train, reminding us how close Emmett Till's story came not happening, or being another story altogether. And that, in turn, should remind us of how any story, sad or happy, is always precariously close to being other than it is. Doesn't take much to alter familiar scene into chaos. Difficult as it is to remember what does occur, we must also try to keep alive what doesn't. The missed trains, squandered opportunities, warnings not heeded. We carry forward these fictions because what might have been is part of what gives shape to our stories. We depend on memory's capacity to hold many lives, not just the ones we appear to be leading at the moment. Memory is space for storing lives we didn't lead, room where they remain alive, room for mourning them, forgiving them. Memory, like all stories we tell, a tissue of remembering, forgetting, of what if and once upon a time, burying our dead so the dead may rise. And that's really what it is that we're doing here. We're, you know, we are burying the dead so the dead may rise, what it is that we're writing. And that's where, I mean, I think for a lot of us, we have either we may not have had a personal connection to the person we're writing about, but over the course of this, we are going to be developing a very personal relationship. And sometimes in writing, you do have to separate those two out. I think just as Carlene was saying yesterday, you kind of write that draft and then you inject these other aspects into it. And that's kind of writing that draft and kind of injecting the personal into it. Now, a few years ago, I taught a course on writing the memoir, and this is one of the things that I said. You know, Tom Robbins said, people write memoirs because they lack the imagination to make things up. And I, you know, I threw that out to my students, and it's really mean. Now, I totally disagree with that assessment of the genre, but I do think that bad memoirs are written because people approach telling the truth in an unimaginative fashion, mm-hmm. often getting bogged down in every single detail from the past. An artfully written memoir should use the same techniques of narrative structure and storytelling one finds in a novel. The writer must capture the setting vividly, have a point of view that keeps the reader's attention, and pace the storytelling with a rhythm that keeps the story moving apace. When the reader reads the last line of a memoir, he or she should feel as if they know the writer intimately, yet still have enough questions to use his or her own imagination to fill in the gaps. Now, I firmly believe that the truth can be told in an imaginative fashion, and what I'd like to talk to you today about some imaginative ways to tell the truth. But I must say, it's not just novelists who really, you know, disparage the memoir as a form. So I'm going to, you know, give Tom Robbins a little bit of a pass there. You know, the great American memoirist Mary Carr famously called the memoir a low-rent art form. She's also said the memoir is the province of weirdos and saints and film stars with fake boobs. Or you could be a prime minister or something. So, well, I'm not a weirdo or a saint, nor am I a film star, but...
I'm not saying fake boobs, right?
No fake boobs.
He didn't say it.
Yeah, I didn't say it.
I said right now.
But I do think that the historical could be made to resonate with the reader when the writer reveals a personal connection with the subject. And I think that's, rather than kind of making this a memoir about a person, it's what is your personal connection with your subject? So what I'd like you all to consider is how your personal connection to your topic might help you get a reader to connect with that topic. And there are ways to do that while still injecting ideas from theology and history into your text. Now from my own writing, it's very rare that what I write is completely rooted in memory. So notice I have this profound need to have some historical context for almost anything that I'm writing. And as I mentioned, I had to go to the house where Mahalia Jackson once lived to kind of think about, well, where did she walk? Where did she, you know, kind of getting a sense of who she was. The sense of place is very important. So, but I also have these, and when Charles assigned this to me, I was thinking, did I ever tell him my stories about my dad and Mahalia Jackson?
No.
Well, it was, when that came to me, I thought, did I one time tell Charles about me? And that's what I thought, is that I had these profound memories of listening to Mahalia Jackson in my house on Sunday morning, almost every Sunday morning, it seems. That's kind of my memory of it. It's probably not accurate. Memory can be a tricky thing. But my writing began in thinking about how Mahalia Jackson and the idea of witness, I felt I needed to put the personal aside while researching the historical. And writing anything personal, and much of my work is very personal, research and reporting, I feel, are crucial. And as Jessica knows, I got my piece in right at the deadline, which is unusual for me since I'm usually the goody-two-shoes who delivers a manuscript early. I was having a really difficult time with this. Mm. I was struggling with writing about Jackson because I'm the type of writer who loves to spend hours in an archive box reviewing letters, unpublished manuscripts, and I had none of that. And I was at a loss for what to do. You know, as I mentioned yesterday, Jackson had an eighth grade education, and the only thing we really had to draw on were these oral histories that she'd done with Studs Terkel, so there's little, very little archival stuff to draw on. And then it hit me, Jackson was a performer at her core. And that's when I began to examine these films of her performance. That was her archival legacy, was her performance. So I started watching Newport Jazz Festival in 1978 and 1970, the March on Washington in 1963, which I keep going back to all the time because I think there was a point where Bayard Rustin wanted to give her the hook. So because she was she was really dragging out, I've been buked and I've been scored. And her many performances in Europe, and particularly at the Franklin Opera House, Frankfurt Opera House. So to write about Jackson, I had to look at performance as witness, and I found a number of historical sources, including her own biography, which supplemented my writing.
There were some biographies?
Yeah. One that she did, it's not very good, and then a couple of others. There's not a really good biography of Jackson, and I think it's because it's hard to get your mind around the subject as a writer, and that I get that. But when I looked at the Newport Jazz Fest performance in 1958, I recognize, and looking out at the crowd, and they pan the crowd, I recognize the power of her witness. And even though I had this memory of, hearing Jackson in my house on Sunday mornings, I was trying to find a way to connect with her. So during my writing, I downloaded a copy of Jackson's double album, Gospel, Spirituals, and Hymns. Mm-hmm. And I would listen to it for inspiration, kind of to get me in the mood of writing and turn it off when I was writing. So in the course of my writing, and I only made it through disc one. Mm-hmm. And after I delivered the manuscript, I finished my first draft. I hadn't delivered it. I'd finished my first draft because I was letting it kind of sit for a little while. I finally got to listen to disc two. And it was a Sunday morning. And the first song on Sunday morning, and that was when kind of those memories of my childhood really started to hit me. And the first song in disc two is In the Upper Room, which was the first song on the album that my father had, Apollo Records from 1957, In the Upper Room, first track, 7 minutes. And he kept this, and I started thinking about this, where was this record? He kept it in his own stash, his Mahalia Jackson records, along with, he also had some Hank Williams records. They were all kept together, and he kept it separate from all the R&B and soul records that my sister had that she would order from Ernie's Record Mark at WLAC in Nashville, Tennessee, your Clear Channel radio station. And when he listened to In the Upper Room, he was always dressed for church. And he had on his dark suit with his dark skinny tie. And he would stand over the record player. And he would, and I was wondering, why did he always do that? Now, that, and I was just kind of thinking about that as I was getting ready to go to Mass that Sunday. So, but although I'm a Catholic, I was raised in the Methodist Church. I was raised in the CME Church. And that is the, in the 40s and 50s, we were the colored Methodist Episcopal Church, and then we became the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. But to our more refined AME brethren, we were the country Methodist. So, Mahalia Jackson's music would have been welcome in my little CME church. And I know that our youth choir, the leader of our youth choir, was ripping off Mahalia Jackson a lot of Sundays. But like Mahalia, and unlike the AMEs, we would shout a little bit. And that Sunday, as I headed out to Mass, in the upper room was in my head. And I'm just trying to figure out, why did he listen to it so intently? And that morning at the consecration, I looked up within the upper room in my head, and I realized that was my father's moment of prayer before church. That was his moment of the real presence of God, was listening to Mahalia Jackson. And those people in that audience at Newport, they were somehow unwittingly participating in the real presence of God, whether they knew it or not. And it was a real moment for me. And I've been kind of writing a little bit, in my trusty Moleskine notebook, just little details about what it was about my father's ritual of listening to Mahalia Jackson. What was he listened to it on? It was a Sears silver tone record player that unfolded out of a black and silver box. And the way he rolled it down the hall on a cart to put it in his room to have this moment of prayer with Mahalia Jackson. And, again, I thought about what he was wearing and how I would be down the hall in my room also getting ready, thinking about, why is he playing that song again? Even though I know I did the same thing with secular music every Sunday, I'm saying, why is he doing again? But it's taken me all of these years and this to make me realize exactly what it was that he's doing. So what I'd like for you to think about with your particular your subjects is, what is your personal connection with the subject of your piece? And if you didn't have one before you started, what is it now that you've kind of started looking at it? And is there a personal experience that you have that you can use to support your basic thesis about the life of witness of your subject? And is there some component of that person's life that really echoes in your own life? Mm-hmm. I'm starting to see this essay for me to be some way of, what is Mahalia Jackson's life? And thinking about how it influenced my own life and that own moment, just recently for me, realizing I never knew until that Sunday morning what my father was doing. Mm-hmm. It was just, I thought, he's doing it again. Can he just, and then you kind of lift it up and put it back over on the same track again. And I once listened to the album all the way through, but he wouldn't do it. So also think about, if you were to blend something personal with the theological or the historical, what are the narrative details? What's the scene? What's the description of place you might use? So all of those are things that I would try to think about this. And if you wanted an exercise that I think would be good for us all to do, and this is what I will often do when I'm writing an essay about something and I want to inject some personal component to it, to let the reader know, well, I'm learning about this topic, but here's kind of what my connection is to it. Write about a personal connection with your subject that's really at the front of your memory. And find a narrative arc or trajectory for that personal connection just in a single paragraph. So like three or four sentences, really, that with a beginning, middle, and end about what that connection is. What's the nature of that connection? And then I think that would be good for us in our writing groups to discuss those, about how we can start to integrate that into what it is that we write about these theological figures. Does that seem like a good approach to everyone? It's just like one paragraph, because generally the approach that I have to say that I've taken in writing memoir and starting, and just remembering starting out in writing a memoir, is I couldn't just sit down and write start to finish. A lot of memoir writing for me, a lot of writing for me, period, is little ideas that I have in my journal, and taking pieces of those and pulling them out and using them. And because right now, I tell you, I have details in here just about, I wrote down, well, there, how big was the Sears Silvertone record player? You can go, I went online and found one. And because Carlene would love this, because I'm thinking about being fact-checked.
Oh, yes. the internet can do that for us all now.
It can do it? Yeah. So it's like, well, what if you're going to say it's a specific model, what does it look like? Describe what it looks like, and kind of how did it fold out? You know, what were the you know, I remember there was a cart that it noisily rolled on down the hall. I remember what it looked like.
Did you order one?
No, I just looked at it online.
You can find one. Song or something.
Well, I've got it on my computer, and I listen to it regularly.
What came of the records? Is your dad's collecting?
I think my sister has them. But it's just, you know, I just, what was the size of it? And then, you know, and that's why, and thinking about that, kind of his keeping his records separate from our records and all of those little details. You have a question?
Yeah, can you explain that part again about the beginning, middle, and end?
I think just having some narrative art, you know, like I first encountered, you know, this person through, you know, reading this book.
Okay.
I read this book, and you know, this is the year I read it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I felt when I was reading it, and you know, at the time, you know, I didn't really connect with it. And then I put it aside, and then all of a sudden, I'm given this assignment to write about it. And then I went back to that book and noticed that I had some notes in the margin of it. So I was clearly thinking about, because that's happened to me too. So
okay.
I've gotten a writing assignment that says, oh, you know, I read a book about that a long time ago.
Okay.
And then I go back to the shelf and I pull it off and I don't remember being really into the topic, but then I open the book and from the marginalia I can tell I was really into this book, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it. I'm like, where was I in my life at that time?
Mm-hmm. So you want us to think about how you were encountering this person, not the subject or the topic.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. It's the beginning, middle, end of our personal connection.
It's the beginning, middle, end of your personal connection. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not their life. It's what's your connection.
Okay. Got it.
And it's really, it's just a few sentences, and it does, and then as, you know, as time goes on, that can probably grow. And as you go along, think about what these personal connections are, because you're going to find more of them as you write, and there may be ways for you to weave them into the larger narrative, because then the reader gets a sense that not only is this you know, this wasn't just an assignment for the writer. There was a real, the writer feels a real connection with this person or figure.
Okay.
And that's, I think that can, you know, we were talking yesterday about how all of these are going to fit together. I think that could be one way that everyone, you can see that each one of the writers who's a contributor to this felt some connection with it. And they may not have felt it at the beginning, when they were assigned it. As I said, I thought I must have at some point had told Charles, oh, you know, I heard Mahalia Jackson every Sunday. And then when I get that, I said, how did he know? And I said, this is very, very, very strange. And I thought, well, I can do this, because I've got this connection with it in some way from my, you know, my background in the the Country Methodist Episcopal Church. So,
so would you write that in your paragraph, or would you?
I would write that in my paragraph that there's that really, you know, that Mahalia Jackson's voice went through my, I guess the way that I said, Mahalia Jackson's voice went through the walls of my house every Sunday morning. Yeah, that's kind of like the, and then, you know, what was the song? How did it, you know, and then, you know, remembering my father standing over the record player with his head bowed and realizing that, and not, I mean, I'm just thinking he's listening, but I'm realizing now he was praying. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that at the time. I thought he was just irritating me. It was irritating me, and it was like, can't he listen to something else? Can't he, you know, he is going to wear out the grooves on that record. But as I said, I did the same thing. But it was okay for me to do it. It wasn't okay for me. I mean, it's kind of the, you know, it's the insouciance of youth. So,
can I just ask a quick question?
Yes.
Wow, this is so helpful. We didn't read this, but we did. I found this book, Trimmer Bliss, that's very similar. It passes around to some of these other books that we've read. Again, this is Heart, Heart, Grace. Mm-hmm. And this is Nancy Mayers. Do you know Nancy Mayers? She's an interesting writer. It's a piece on Our Lady of Guadalupe. And if I could just tell you, just read my notes real quick and just ask you, like, how to resolve this problem that I've sort of seen.
Okay, we'll see if I can.
Her essay, Mayers, opens with an autobiographical passage of some thousand words, hinting vaguely at the subject. I know this is too harsh. Mm-hmm. This is my first, I was just reading it. I think I dictated this on the elliptical into my iPhone, so don't hold me to it. But vaguely hinting at the subject of the chapter, Our Lady of Guadalupe, at which time, after a thousand words, she offers the reader a 10-paragraph account, historical account, that could come off of Wikipedia, only then to abruptly return to memoir. It's sort of the two-thirds mark in the essay. The historical observations, so in this piece, serve memoir and are intriguing and idiosyncratic. The writing, though, seems to obscure the revelatory power of the character. And sometimes the theological insight, as I'm saying, and this could be totally wrong, but sometimes the theological insight must be stated, like flatly, told, as it were, perhaps in a gesture of literary writerly humility, repentance, like, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to have to tell you something. Okay, so this is not what writers should be doing, but in an act of literary repentance, here's a theological proposition. So straining to capture the bird in flight, to capture the bird in flight will always finally chasten language and creative aspirations, like to try to capture the illumination. Anyway, and then so Mayers rewards the patient theological reader in the end with two final luminous pages of theological exposition. It's wonderful.
She's buried the lead.
Sorry?
But she's buried the lead. Yeah. Carlin's nodding her head.
And then first to be inviting comfortable words, autobiographical. It's like an autobiography. It has a sermonic kind of autobiographical. The first part is like these autobiographical words. The second part is a little heavy scaffolding of historical narrative. Then there's another personal insight or three, and then with a final sort of beautiful two-page exposition on the preferential option for the poor and Catholic moral theology and so forth. So that seems like, you know, a formula that would work.
Yeah.
But it's not satisfying if you're looking for this as a theological
Yeah, I mean, it's because she's really buried the theological, her basic thesis is buried in the text toward the end. Is that needed to be much more upfront. That here's kind of what I see, and then here's how it's worked out in her life. Here's how it's here's how it's worked out here. And then kind of coming back to the personal, and then coming back to the theological. So really starting out with that theological point, but going to the personal, the historical, but it sounds to me as if they're just not, she didn't really have good transitions between these different points. And then her thesis, she states her thesis at the end. It sounds to me, from what you're...
And Danielle, as a professor of homiletics, I mean... This must be something that you're especially attentive to, is, you know, the form, structure of the sermon that kind of works you through the three, you know, different moves to deliver in the final minutes some kind of payoff.
So in terms of homiletics, I think it's really different because when someone's listening to something, their tolerance for mood and structure are far more limited generally than someone's tolerance on the page. So
that's very true. When I've written for radio, I have to rewrite than what I would write for my own for reading.
Right.
It's very different.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
And the ear takes longer, it's much longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the themes we sung over and over again, that you actually present the melodies of passive voice because of the ear and brain to catch
church
up.
Church fans. But what, when you think about sermon writing, I mean, there are similarities, though, between the form and construction of story that...
Yeah, I mean,
I think there's certainly similarities in terms of where one begins, one's connection. The other big piece of sermons is sound. So the sound of a person's voice carries the meaning. So it's not just the content that's on the page, but the actual vocal intonations, the person of the preacher is speaking alongside whatever that person is saying. Whereas when one's reading text, unless one knows the body of the author, then there's a little bit more space there to get to know the person.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Oh,
that's
really
helpful.
Ask a question.
Yes. Rob, I'm wondering about the genre. You came to mind for me yesterday and then again today, I'm thinking about sort of how these things are constructed. I keep thinking about a sort of long form profile. Right?
Yes.
Like, I mean, there's a long-form profile of Fred Rogers that I love. It was in Esquire years ago by Tom Chenault. I don't know how to say his name, but he recently wrote one by Hillary Clinton, which is also lovely. But the sort of interspersing of history and narrative, and I know at least his one about Fred Rogers, it starts and ends with these little vignettes from his own childhood. And so there's a real mix of the sort of personal history and the person's story and then some historical details that have to be in there to go with it. But it's very, as you read it, it feels very fluid as it makes those shifts, mm-hmm. and it makes them pretty frequently. And so, again, I'm not sure how to define that as a genre.
But that's, I think, so it's, so I think it's really, that's, so it's a profile very often kind of blends aspects of the personal essay,
mm-hmm.
and memoir,
mm-hmm.
very often. If the writer, you know, but then, you know, the writer has to know when they can insert themselves into it and when to pull back. It's like, as I said, when I was writing those three pieces, it was like I did not want to insert myself in that. Mm-hmm. I wanted kind of purely to have what her life was like, because at this point, it's no. My life isn't important, but for the reader to connect with it, it's at least there's a reason why I'm writing about this topic, so that the reader knows that he has some connection with this topic. It's not as if I'm an expert on. I'm not a music writer. I'm not an expert on music, but there's some connection I have with this topic. and that's, but yes, I think the aspect of profile writing and you know, reading some profiles would be really helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It could be interesting, I mean, if you, anybody, like if there are sort of favorites that we could come up with a list of links that we could send out.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to, I mean, we should probably make a copy of this for everyone too, the Emmett Till essay, kind of, this is by John Edgar Wideman, and he, you know, he talks about his connection with that photograph. And
Ralph, what do you think about kind of beginning with, so I'm hesitant with this because I really have a kind of, I hate young memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Just see, I mean, you know, it's, you get a lot of kids who are just out of college, just out of graduate school, and they're writing memoirs, you know, you're like, well, who cares? I feel similar, you know, if I were to do this, that what is my connection? You know, I mean, I think for you, writing the memoirs about the school, well, this event in history bears the weight, right? And that's what's important about reading about it. But I wonder if there's a way in which kind of starting with, I love the idea of starting with this, because I think for me, connecting to my figure was, how do I get to this person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is really important. But then maybe if another step, what I try to do in a certain way to think about it, is then kind of, how also then do I write myself out of it?
Right.
Yeah, and I think you're onto something there. It's really important that because sometimes a writer can do something like this and you realize, I'm learning all about the writer. I'm learning nothing about the figure. And that's where you really have to be careful. It's like there's a certain point, I really don't care what how this song made you feel. What about her life?
Yeah.
And it's like, and then sometimes you just have to say, well, sometimes there's that aside, you say, well, kind of like a transition there. Let's kind of move in away from enough about me.
Yeah.
And then kind of going back to it. So, but I agree with you. There's sometimes when the memoir can be that, you know, it can be that low-rent art form.
Yes. Yeah.
And sometimes when that's what you're stretching, you're putting yourself into it too much. And I think that the trick is writing yourself out of it and then knowing when to write yourself in. I know my own editor told me at a certain point, you have written yourself out of this too much because you were trying to not insert yourself, but I know what your connection is with this.
Yeah.
You've got to tell me.
So I'm what you're describing,
because I know your figures, this particularly. I've been thinking about you as when I was getting ready to talk today.
Because the pieces that I wrote for our group, mm-hmm. they're all kind of autobiographical about my interaction with Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one I've been struggling with, what you said about sometimes the impact of someone like Richard and Mahalia, which is that their impact is more personal and feeling. And you're hearing them speak and you're hearing them sing. So it's hard to describe what they're doing to elicit that emotion out of you. But I feel like I can describe the emotion that I'm feeling when I'm hearing Richard talk to me,
mm-hmm.
or when I'm hearing a musical piece. And so does that become kind of the inroad into their life? So I'm the lens through which someone who's never met Richard can say, this is the kind of impact that he has emotionally on a person when you talk to him.
That's exactly what I think you should be doing with your piece.
Mm-hmm.
That you have a very unique perspective on all of this. And that's when I heard that you knew Richard so well, I thought, boy, this is a great opportunity. But then there's also, it's kind of, well, where do those things stop and go? So that it's not a story about your relationship, it's a story about him.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the real tricky part of doing that. And it's like knowing when to write yourself out of it. And sometimes I think with a lot of younger people who are writing the memoir, you can, when you're younger, you're a lot more self-absorbed.
Right.
And that, that later on, but I mean, but you know, when you're like me and you're kind of looking toward the end, you've got some you can be retrospective about it, but then you also know, everybody doesn't want to hear all about me.
And you can just
kind of do that.
Yeah.
In my world, I've been married to a songwriter for 28 years. And the way he talks about it, I love the way you describe it, and the way he describes it is big ego, little ego. Mm-hmm. And it's important to have both of those things. If you don't have them both, you can't write a song. And so the big ego is like, damn, I got an idea, and it's good enough, and my thoughts are worthy of this piece of paper, and you gotta have an ego. And then you completely get out of the way and some artist interprets it and sings it in your mind.
Yes.
And you have to have both to do that work. And I think what you're saying is you have to have both to do that.
I think that is exactly right. It's you have to have
big
both.
Ego.
Yeah. And that is a great description. I never thought about it.
Well, the little ego here, that's great too. Would come with in all of our works. When I'm just thinking of your but when you just described your challenge, would be that you do need to deliver a story. We need to know who he did, who he was, when he was born, what is where he's located in this framework of radical Christian social witnesses, 1900s. maybe the 10-paragraph Wikipedia-esque narrative is just something that does require a little ego in some regards. I mean, I've heard Richard Twiss's name mentioned, for years, but I don't know his story. I don't know where his significance is, both in evangelical and in American religious history.
But I also think, another aspect of the vignette that God gave you, by virtue of your life, is also kind of your key thesis for your interpretation of the Paleocrit, right?
Mm-hmm. So yes.
It's not, it has a really intrinsic connection to the story you want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, this is an interaction I had with Mahalia Jackson as a child, and it really has nothing to do with the interpretation I'm going to get. It's just the only one I have, So it seems to me to really work, it also has to have this sort of really integrated. You've got to figure out how to integrate it.
Yeah, you do have to figure out how to integrate it, and I think that goes back to Charles's point about where that theological that thesis comes into play, and that's very early on, because otherwise, we say in the business, the lead's buried. No one knows what the real story is. So getting that real story up front, and then say, this is the story they're going to tell. Now I want to sit back and read this. And then you learn about their life, and then you realize, well, the writer has some connection with this person's life. And why they can write about this life with some authority. It's not just that they, researched it and went to an archive. It's that they've got some connection with this. And that they really saw how they feel and they are, or they understand the power of their witness. That they really do understand that.
And that turns to that cinematic lens that Carlene offered us yesterday. I mean, is there a way in which the camera would go from your father the Sunday morning listening to Mahalia and the Sears silver tone
record player,
what year is this? 64
probably.
I mean, that's 64, and then Mahalia. I mean, could you then move the lens from your dad, and now it's Mississippi 64, and where's Mahalia in 64? She probably comes in.
I mean, you can really, you could really move it out of there and into to her. Well, it wasn't 64. It was in the 50s. It was actually, she did a she did a free performance in Montgomery during the bus boycott. Mm-hmm. She did a big concert in Montgomery that, you know, when they asked her, what is your fee going to be? She said, I don't charge walking people. Mm-hmm. and
wow.
So, yeah, that's exactly what
you, there may be cases, and it sounds like this could be one where the personal observation leads directly into the historical.
Now, yeah, it's very close to her time performing at the March on Washington, which
exactly.
I remember watching with my father. I remember seeing Mahalia Jackson there, you know, singing "I've been buked and I've been scorned," and it's interesting, kind of looking at a lot of the clips of it. There were lots of different perspectives taken on that. There was what you saw on television, and there's what filmmakers actually capture to her closer that day. So there's a lot of different perspectives you can get on it, which is something, you know, just thinking about how the visual, for me, I think this is a case where the visual is really informing what it is that I write. So sometimes that cinematic approach can be, I mean, I've got stuff that's cinematic already to use, but kind of creating that, thinking about how you create that, and I'm not saying that's easy to do. I have struggled with that sometimes. I for a piece I did for Wired last summer, I was really struggling talking about the cinematic and trying to get people into Mississippi and broadband access. You know, you're thinking, how do I do this? It's Mark Saltzman said, as a writer, you hit your head up against a wall and you hope that at the end of the day you've made a little chip there, and then you go back the next day and you hit your head up against there again and there's another little chip that comes out. And that's...
Yeah.
That's a just... And finally you break through it.
Or break your head.
No, you don't break your head, you break through it.
Pete, did you have a...
Oh, just lots of thoughts. I mean, too many. I really like... I'm just sort of thinking this through the sort of words. I've been doing stuff with music and theology, and I really like this idea of real presence being in song. Mm. And... The king has, you know, the same iconic image almost, but just switch the personality. He has this "I have a dream" thing, which is so iconic, on the same steps. But she has a song.
She has a song, and she actually is the one who encouraged him to riff that day.
Right. Mm. And so
to say, you know, get off script, Martin. Yeah. Tell him about the dream.
Right. Mm. And this idea that the power of the song being the real presence was brought that day. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and then also, you know, sometimes he would call her and have her sing on the phone to him.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he'd call her up and say,
yeah, can you see? I mean, there was a scene in Selma where that happened. Mm-hmm. And that actually did happen. Mm-hmm. He would call Mahalia Jackson and have her sing for him.
Which and is a great vignette, because that is actually really weird behavior on one level.
Yeah, it is.
You need to acknowledge that, right? She's like, oh my god, I'm here. What's wrong?
It's Martin like, again.
It's, oh, it's... Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm sure she wants, but...
that idea of music and the connection with music, but there's
get a gramophone, you know, get a sort of recorded these. You don't have to keep calling. But your father though is doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like he's calling her up on the royal telephone, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jesus on the main line.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is you've got live situations that you're writing. I mean, your dad was listening to a recording, and that was live to him, but there's also what goes back to the homiletic point you're making, that it's coming through the person at the moment, and that it's an event. So,
yep.
Performance is event, and
word,
so
even
some word. It's also the loneliness thing that we were talking about yesterday. Mm-hmm. King felt profoundly lonely in the times, and that was his connection. That was, I mean, in this really odd, in a way, from my perspective, piece of behavior, but it was very real.
Yeah, it's someone who was so public, yet he was so lonely.
Yeah.
And and I think there was some aspect of that in Jackson's life as well. You know, some real loneliness. And I think that may have been their connection, actually.
In Thurman, you talk about it as loneliness of all the truth seekers that have to go beyond the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're not lonely, you're not being a witness.
Mm-hmm.
Really. When he says that you are a truth seeker, you have to go out. And whatever you feel comfortable with, you have to go be lonely.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but that's a good point.
Can you just talk, this is so helpful, can you say, you listed a few,
you want me to
a few points, sort of suggestions about just the construction of narrative, and one is one that we all know and remember from our English courses in high school or college, but can you, it strikes me as very important as we think about these narratives, and that's just point of view and sense of place. So, what do we need to be thinking about in terms of point of view? And do you think that it's place that would be the kind of grounding?
I think place is the real the grounding. I mean, and that's you know for me at least that's. That's so important because very often when I remember when I was teaching my class in the memoir and I was workshopping pieces with my students, you know, they would write something, you know, something, and I would say, well, where did this happen?
Yeah.
When did this happen?
Yeah.
Kind of put me into the place and time where all of this took place. You've got great description here. I love the description, but I don't have a sense of where I am and where this is in time. And so that's kind of, so because sometimes that time and place really dictate the point of view, because there are going to be things that are going to be so different in thinking about someone writing in the 60s, and that's why I kind of mentioned the Ernie's record shop and buying the records, listening to the radio, when now for me to listen to Mahalia Jackson, I just clicked on iTunes and I had that in a matter of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But there used to be this anticipation of getting a record in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it on the radio, and then you order the record in the mail. And
you can still do that.
You can still do that, but but no one really does that. It's like
my son does that. Records come every day.
Yeah, I mean, they're I think his generation has kind of realized there's something important about that kind of delayed gratification rather than the immediate gratification we get and just getting something right away. And but that gives you a different sense of it. Where that is. It's so I guess, does that answer your question with respect? Because I think knowing that something, if you're talking about something that's in the 60s, that's going to be very different than talking about something that's happening in the 70s. Because who was talking about the 70s yesterday?
Garnett
was talking about the 70s yesterday. And that does put you in a very different place. There's a lot of different, culturally, things were so different in the 70s. And if you know that it's 1975, or it's 1973, and it's at the heart of Watergate, that's going to have, what were people talking and thinking about? And then also sometimes realizing that a lot of your readers were not alive at that time, describing for them what that time was like. Just having taught a class on civil rights and literature this last semester, I had to explain to my students a lot about this is what life was like at that time. Mm-hmm. And these were the constraints. These were the things you could and could not do. This is why this writer has taken this approach to this topic, because this is the time, historically, where it all fits in. And that can be really... And I think sometimes a reader needs to know that, because a lot of our readers may not know that.
I'd love to see that syllabus.
Sure, I
could. I'd love to see the syllabus of history of Christian discipleship, too. That's really wonderful.
Yeah. I'm wondering how, so given kind of yesterday, today kind of thing, I'm just thinking in my head, okay, so on the one side, I was really attracted to the idea of, okay, let's find an object, right? The problem, though, in like a lot of this historical work is that I'm thinking, in late 50s when, or right around 60 when Chavez, Fred Ross, kind of finally gets the Chavez family to agree to a house meeting, right? And they gather in their little dilapidated shack in South Cienfuegos, and he gives the spiel. I have the object that they have a shack, but I have no visual. Like, there's nothing in the documents that kind of can paint that for me. So
I would even say the way you were talking, I thought, yes, tell me more. Step by step took us to the house.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't Technicolor, but that, get us to the house. This is maybe too obvious to say, but if you're talking about trying to recreate a decade, just there was a book about the 20s that I read when I was reading up on Dorothy Day, and it really didn't, because she was mentioned once, but just to get the flavor of a generation, it's not a good phrase, but just to understand what were the youth of her time concerned with, like what parties did they go to, what did they drink when they go to those parties. And so even reading memoirs by people, even if they didn't know the people that you're writing about, reading memoirs, if it's possible, of that time, just to understand like what were fellow travelers, as it were, wearing, reading,
right,
thinking, doing.
Right.
That might help you create those. I mean, now we have everything on the internet, which is, you could, and I've sort of done this when I was writing about a Philadelphia neighborhood in a novel I wrote, and it was one that my grandmother grew up in, and I've never been there, but I grew up a half hour away from it. But I went on the internet, and I looked at the row homes, and I tried to find pictures of the church she might have gone to, just so I could see it and feel like, well, what does Stoop Home look like?
Yeah.
What would have been outside? So I was, in the novel I ended up writing, I put a fact check on me, I could have, could you grow roses outside? Maybe not helpful for the creative process, but could you grow roses outside? Were they for that? Would there have been room?
Right.
So I think reading material that you probably already done this, reading material that's not about your subject, but about the period, just watching, Mad Men is, that they did a lot of research to make you feel that, people respond to that. People who were there, don't want to watch it because it's too real.
Right.
But it was created by people who, were in a way there, but then sometimes never there to begin with.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I think looking at photographs and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that, kind of counterbalancing it with like the point of view and location and sense of like so taking you into this. But then for me, I'm not a historian, so I don't know. But when I write dates, it feels like a waste of space, right? When you say May 5th, 1966, there's no imagery there, right? There's nothing to kind of.
For some people, there might be.
Right?
If you give me a date, what happened? But that's, I'm crazy that way.
I'm
not a day in a year.
Yeah, I am too.
But if I were to say, it's barely 5 years after the Montgomery bus boycott.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So I'm locating
similarly,
but very differently.
Right.
So that I have a bit of the kind of, okay, I know where we are historically a little bit more now. As opposed to just like when I drop a date, I'm kind of like, what happened in 66? I remember I was alive.
That's a good way to, what was I going to say? That idea of you're talking about, you can get a lot of these images on the internet. The other thing too for Chavez is, I would bet you, and this is my pet peeve as a researcher is there's so much that's online, but then there's so much that's actually in an archive that's undigitized. That's the stuff we very often these days ignore. And that's where a lot of the real finds can be. Yeah. There could be a photograph of Chavez's house.
Right.
Yeah. So you can to actually to go inside. That capturing that that time and saying, oh, that's the house, that's the shack, and about how big was it? And you can probably even go find a map where it was. And it may even have the dimensions of it. You can say it was only this big.
Or like what month it what was the weather? Speaking of California, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
What was the weather in California at that time? Had there been you could even look up like newspaper newspaper archives or something like that to find you might be able to find weather for whatever date that was. I've tried to do that and I can't remember if I was successful or not. But you can't say
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you so much.